Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The Hidden Hotspots, a New Scientist article from the 7th of September, standard cognitive rehab, trying just to improve my reading skills and also memorise a few things. I do the podcast, then try and remember what I've written to write it up a little bit. Just keep on pushing all the time. So I've got a few pictures, unusual pictures here. And it's to preserve the diversity of the world's wildlife. Kate Ravilos finds we should focus on unusual terrain, not animals and plants. The disused quarry in Cheffoir in western France doesn't seem that it would be high on anyone's conservation watch list. A swampy marsh leads to a sinister-looking pit pond guarded by a dense thicket and overhung by trees and shrubs. Above the pond, a staircase of rock walls stretches skywards, while mosses and ferns monopolise the dank, shady corners. Although a far cry from the classic nature havens like the Galapagos Islands, this somewhat uninspiring landscape could rival them in value. Not only is the quarry brimming with wildlife, including many rare and threatened species, but the secrets to its biodiversity could help us save all life on our planet. It is now widely accepted that the Earth has experienced the sixth mass extinction event. The United Nations estimates that about 1 million species are threatened, and many have already been lost to human activity. We can't save everything, so how do we prioritise? Until now, the focus has been on biodiversity hotspots, locations with good habitats and support, exceptional concentration of different species. But maybe our efforts have been misguided. Instead of focusing on specific species and habitats, one of the best ways of putting the brakes on the current mass extinctions may be to protect our planet's rocks and soils, its geodiversity. They may not look like much, but neglected quarries and unloved scrublands may be the key to ensuring long-term survival of life on Earth. The change in perspective emerged around a decade ago. Mark Anderson at Nature Conservancy, a conservation charity in the US, was assessing which areas of the landscape they should prioritise. Quote, I realised that we were buying up land to protect the species living there now, but climate change impacts might mean it wouldn't be the right place in future, says Anderson. That led to an epiphany. Instead of buying land with great biodiversity today, he decided to look at areas that would retain their diversity when the planet warmed. Well, as I say, that far out, I'm a bit attacked by these absolutely spectacular parrots. Sorry, I can't feed you. Or what? Let's talk about biodiversity. This brilliant red parrot. I'm sorry, mate. I can't do it. Can you hear it? Do you want to say anything? Do you want to say anything? It's pretty amazing. These parrots are basically tame. Okay. His initial focus was on landscapes with a wide range of microclimates, places in which nooks and crannies, slopes and hills, sunshine and shade, wet and dry. The thinking was, even if the climate in the region changed significantly, the local climate variability would be greater, giving new species greater chance of finding a suitable new habitat locally. To test the idea, Anderson and his colleagues started tracking how species richness changed with landscape. Oh, get off, parrot. These parrots are right almost attacking me. It's pretty amazing. Okay. As long as I don't congregate the mass, there's about, I don't know, about 10 parrots about the moment. Okay. Climates across 14 states and 3 Canadian provinces. They found that over 90% of the species diversities in temperate climates could be explained by just 4 landscape features: the number of rock types, latitude, elevation, range, and amount of chalk and lime in the bedrock. Quote, we expected landscapes to influence species diversity, but we were surprised by just how strong the link was. In retrospect, it makes good sense. Geology affects the chemical and physical properties of the soil and water. As Anderson suspected, it also influences local climate via topography it creates. The more geodiverse the underlying landscape, the greater the range of habitats, the more species in a region can support. Quote, it seems that unusual or contrasting geologies can stimulate evolutionary diversification, says Anderson. This sounds confused to me, but yeah. Changing focus to geodiversity could be beneficial in other ways. Collecting biodiversity data is time-consuming and expensive. Some of the most biodiverse areas in the world are almost certainly unrecognised and unprotected because no one has recorded what lives there. Geodiversity is easy to recognise and getting easier all the time. Joseph Bailey, a geographer of York St. John University, UK, has been working on a way to use satellite data to measure geodiversity automatically. By homing in on very geodiverse regions, we can pinpoint where our most biodiverse locations are likely to be and target our conservation efforts. The strategy pioneered by Anderson was gradually gathered traction. He and his colleagues have now mapped geodiversity and estimated the resilience of the landscape across most of the United States of America. The Rockies and desert areas of the southwest United States are the last two outstanding areas which they hope to complete by the end of the year. Their work suggests that to give the US wildlife the greatest chance of adapting and surviving to future climate change courtesy of Donald Trump, around a quarter of the US landscape needs to have protected status. Thanks to the Nature Conservancy and a number of other agencies, 40% of those resilient locations are already protected. Now their focus is on the remaining 60%. Their wish list may seem surprising, with overworked farmland and dull chunks of prairie often ranking above pristine wilderness. But Anderson believes that if the land is in the right place and underneath and underlain by the right mix of rocks, then these areas can have greater conservation values. Right at the top of the list are places that can provide corridors of the landscape, ensuring there is room for wildlife to move between habitats as climate changes. Quote, our work has identified some really scary pinch points, he says. Disused quarries are another surprising poster child for conservation movement. The range of gradients and variety of microclimates, hot south-facing slopes and cool, shady north-facing crannies, make for a massive range of ecological niches. In 2013, study of Chefwire found that it represents a beacon of biodiversity in an area where intensive farming practices have long threatened wildlife. Its multitude of different landforms supports 27 kinds of cricket alone, along with hundreds of plants including rare mosses, ferns and rock-loving flowers. The UK landscape is peppered with such sites, but many are being sold off as rubbish dumps. The pressure to use old quarries as landfill sites is huge, says John Faith of the University of Glasgow, UK. Some such as Tern Quarry in Ayrshire have already been stuffed full of rubbish, and others face uncertain futures. But there are success stories too. Thanks to campaigning efforts of geologists, two Scottish open cast coal mines, Spirelack and Mains Hill Wood, may soon become geoconservation sites. Today, peregrine falcons nest on the hunt from Spirelack's exposed cliffs, while curlews and lapwings relish the undisturbed moor and grassland nearby. Okay, geodiversity also applies underwater. As a recent Finnish study shows, quote, we find that greater geodiversity, the higher the aquatic plant species richness, says Mario Chaljovin of the University of Oulu. Saving geodiversity on its own won't save the planet. Bailey mapped the plant species richest across the UK and compared it against the geodiversity. He found that there was a very strong link between the two. Wow. But that there were inevitable exceptions to the rule. Single geologies that bred a diversity of life. Or multiple diversities which aren't anything. What's more, there are also very geodiverse areas that are comparatively barren, such as the high mountain environments that are rock-rich but fairly hostile places to live. Quote, I see geodiversity as another string to the bow of conservation rather than being something we should switch to completely, says Bailey. Even so, It's a string that has so far been underused. We've done a reasonable job of protecting majestic landscapes, lush islands, awe-inspiring coastlines and dramatic mountaintops, but the less photogenic pieces of land aren't well loved. If we want to stop the mass extinction of life on our planet, we'll need to fight it not only on the beaches, but on the hills, but in the floodplains and the quarries too. Isn't that beautiful? We will fight them. Okay. And this next article, just because I want to get a bit of stimulus up. The Last Mile Revolution. Our love of online shopping has caused a pile-up of polluting vans. Chris Storkel Walker navigates. I love Storkel Walker. Navigates the technology that can reinvent home delivery. Paul Wright didn't know what to expect when he showed up for his first job. For the previous few years, he had earned his keep playing online poker, but he was in a relationship now and needed a stable income. With a lengthy gap in his CV, he had decided to take work where it was. There's lots of it in demand, a delivery driver at Amazon. It was a rude awakening. One of his first shifts involved driving some 50 kilometres around the northeast of England, including through a toll system, dropping off packages as he went. By the time you take off a $1.70 toll charge and the petrol for the huge route, it makes the hourly rate terrible, says Wright. He was driving great distances, crisscrossing regions, yet earning less than he had from the comfort of his living room. Well, there you go. Woes of workers in the gig company have long been making headlines. What rarely is considered is the problem that deliveries create for the environment and wildlife in cities. Vans aren't just carrying packages and stresses drivers, they're also belching out air pollution and clogging up our streets. That affects us all. It doesn't have to be this way. If we are smart, we can make deliveries less painful for people like Wright and less polluting for us all. Making more deliveries on bikes or even delivery robots could help. Some people want to go even further and completely reinvent the way we do home delivery. 10 or 20 years ago, many of us drove to the supermarket to do food shopping. When you need a new skirt or a new shirt, you went to the high street. People only had things delivered when they really needed it, and it had been like that for decades. Online shopping still accounts for only about a tenth of retail sales in many developed countries. But what is important is the pace of growth. In 2015, each UK household placed just over 2 online orders a month. Next year, the average household is predicted to order something like twice that, once a week. It is the final leg of the parcel's journey where the problem crops up. Known figuratively as the last mile, well, I say literally, doesn't it? Until this stage, many goods have taken the same route, shipped around the world in huge vessels and driven along motorways and lorries. Then they arrive at the distribution centre, normally just outside a large town. At this point, their routes diverge, splintering and slowing like a river delta, as the packages wend their way to busy residential streets and city centres. Most deliveries are made by vans. In London alone, vans make up 400,000 personal delivery to offices every day. The number of kilometres driven by vans each year is soaring. See the graph on page 45, which you can't. I'm on page 43. The bad news, this is bad news, because vans are more polluting than cars. They spit out more nitrous oxide, poisonous gases, and can reduce lung function, irritate the eyes, and corrode the teeth. Well, there you go. That's really going for it. Root of the problem. When Wright arrived for his first shift, he was guided to a line of vehicles waiting to receive their packages. He had to sign up for work with Amazon Flex app, and he used this to sign in by scanning his QR code at the depot. Then he was given a collection of packages. When he was ready to set off, the app calculated a driving route for him. In theory, the algorithm works out the most efficient route, although that is a notorious difficult problem to solve. Wright later learned that experienced Flex drivers use their own nous and other wayfinding apps to complete their deliveries faster. The alternative routes can make a big difference. Oliver Bates at Lancaster University and his colleagues recently studied 25 UK delivery drivers who were working in a single day. They found a pair of drivers who had determined the same number had delivered the same number of packages in the same areas, but one managed to drive 44% shorter route and spend 35% less time delivering each package on average. That suggests drivers can be more efficient. Quote, "A lot of technological advances and investments has been made on the depot side of sorting and filtration, but the pointy end of this spear, the drivers, are still doing things much in the same way," says Sarah Wise, the University College of London, who worked with the Bates on this study. The navigation system used by Amazon, DPD, FedEx and other delivery firms are often inefficient, and many are adapted from those haulage forms that move freight along distances, not around cities. One problem they don't account for is that the registered address of the company might not be the place where the packages need to be dropped off. A bigger annoyance is that the system takes drivers to the delivery address without factoring in the need to park. It's not more efficient for drivers to leave their vehicle in one place and deliver several items on foot, rather than finding multiple parking spots. I can see robots really coming into this. Seasoned drivers know all this, but thanks to low wages, this job is with a high turnover. Part of the solution could be to make navigation systems smarter and more precise, says Julian Allen, who studies urban infrastructure at the University of Westminster. There are several systems that divide the Earth's surface into smaller chunks. These could be used to direct drivers' delivery points more precisely than an address. Rather than directing a driver to pull up at an office block on a busy road or with no parking, they could explicitly direct them to the nearest parking place and then plot a walking route to the office. Parking predicament. Bates and his colleagues have developed a system that does this, calculating delivery routes while where driving and walking are accounted for. When they tested it on a case study of 144 package deliveries, they could reduce the time of delivery route took by a fifth. All this makes what may be an unreasonable assumption, however, that the parking spaces are actually available. Quote, "Parking is a pretty big issue," says Matthias Winkerbach, director of Mega Logistics Lab at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Quote, "If you pick a random street in Manhattan these days, you'll probably see a UPS or FedEx trucks outside parked on the road in minutes. It's something writers are very familiar with. If I parked legally, my four-hour shift would have me been 10 hours long," he says. A raft of startups are trying to alleviate the problem for both delivery drivers and commuters by using internet-connected sensors to provide real-time information on empty parking spaces. One example is the US startup Fibra. Its technology involves embedding hockey puck-sized sensors in the tarmac. The difficulties do not stop there. Some cities are making big moves to reduce pollution and are forcing delivery companies to rethink their methods. In April, London introduced an ultra-low emission zone, ULZE, which within which vehicles must meet strict environmental standards or pay a toll. The city of Hamburg in Germany has gone further. In May, it banned commercial vehicles from its council streets. Delivery firm UPS decided to move its depot from outside Hamburg to much closer in the centre. It was expensive, but it meant the last mile delivery could be handled by couriers on electric pedal bikes with trailers. The firm was forced into the move, but it actually turned out to be cheaper, says Rickenbach. As a result, similar schemes are now cropping up in Europe and the US. In Paris, for instance, delivery porters pick up their parcels from the Chaise Vue depot on the River Seine, then deliver them by bicycle or tricycle. Banning vehicles from cities can raise the hackles for delivery firms. More generally, experimenting with new delivery methods is expensive for firms, which can mean they are loath to try, which in turn means nothing changes. Wise hopes that is that by conducting research and models of delivery, she can test out the industry-wide changes that would be beneficial for the whole city, without anyone, a company, having to make a risk investment to unproven strategies. One of her ideas is to introduce a courier's courier, a single centralised carrier that would organise deliveries from various firms in an area. That one company would be a single point contact for the city groups, removing duplication of vehicles, alleviating the fight for parking spaces. The carrier would be independent of others, so no one firm would have a monopoly, but it would share resources. Newt Cargo already carries out some of the last mile deliveries using electric vans on behalf of several companies. More radical still would be to remove drivers and the equation out of the equation entirely. Dora-based company Airlift and Dutch startup Geber Technologies are testing deliveries by drone in Rotterdam, while Israeli firm Flytrex is delivering packages from Icelandic e-commerce company Aha to around half of Reykjavik's. The question is, where does the drone do the delivery? Says Wise FedEx. Drones hover over outside a building, then lower the items down a cord. That won't work everywhere. An easier way is to get robots involved, maybe to have them remain on the pavement. In January, a small six-wheeled blue and black box began trundling along the streets near the Amazon Seattle headquarters. These Amazon Scout robots are currently being accompanied by a human, but the hope is that they will eventually be able to deliver packages alone. FedEx has also revealed a similar-looking LiDAR-enabled device called the FedEx Same Day Bot that will be piloted in US cities over the coming months. Another startup, Starship Technologies, has been testing its robots in Washington, D.C. for more than a year and delivers the first packages to Milton Keynes, UK, in November 2018. These robots are electric, meaning they are potentially emission-free. They don't contribute to traffic congestion. They are also evidence that we will have little trouble accepting them. Researchers from Harvard University recently had robot posing as a delivery agent for a fictional startup robot group approach, a student dormitory, and asked people to let them in. 16 out of 21 people did so, suggesting that, if anything, we trust robots a little too much. Return to centre. The problem with home deliveries are compounded by one thing before. Many deliveries take more than one attempt. Drivers often arrive to drop off a parcel only to find the recipient isn't home. That can mean they have to take a nut to another depot, then it has become back again, multiplying the traffic and pollution. Many online retailers offer a return package for free, as has an effect on how we shop. 2. Packages ping pong between buyers and sellers, with many customers conditioned to overorder and return. About a quarter of the items bought online in the UK are sent back for a refund exchange. That figure is on an upward trajectory. Europe's second biggest delivery firm, DPD, for example, saw a doubling in the number of items returned between 2017 and 2018. Finding ways to help customers avoid returns is among the biggest things we have to do to stem the tide of delivery-related traffic. In fashion, where the return rates are among the highest, there are options. Designers can be smart about the sizing of their clothes, for instance. One group of academics and the major UK retailer is using 3D body scanners to identify the size and shape of 11,000 people in the US. You're fat, fat, fat. That information is used to create a more representative sizing and cuts the clothes compared to the conventional method of basing designs on a supposedly representative body model. Oh dear. Ultimately, if anything is to change, consumers must change their behaviour, which is easier said than done. Quote, "I definitely shop online," says Wright. "Who knows the impact of on-demand delivery is better than most. Do I feel guilty? I mean, a little, but for the bourgeois democracy and capitalistic ideology we live within," he says. He surely has a point. No one can be transformed the last mile on their own. But if we all make the right changes, we might just turn the juggernaut around. So I think Juggernaut is a large Hindu horse or thing. It's on a road. It's on rollers, and they push it up through the hill. And once it starts to roll down the hill, like that's Juggernaut. I'll do, and it's on the internet. Thanks for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.